Good afternoon, everyone. Wonderful to see you, and I hope the retreat's going well for you. I'm going to begin today by telling a story about one of the great Chinese masters, Ma Tzu, and a monk who was his student and would later become his Dharma heir, Pai Chang. Ma Tzu and Pai Chang are arguably known as perhaps the two greatest Zen masters in the Tang Dynasty. This story is nothing particularly special about it, but it leads up to what I want to talk about today. One day, Ma Tzu and Pai Chang went out for a walk, as they often did. And during these walks, Ma Tzu would sometimes test Pai Chang's insight. You can never tell with these Zen masters. On this particular walk, a flock of wild ducks flew overhead. And Ma Tzu turned to Pai Chang and said, looking up, "What's that?" Pretty straightforward. Pai Chang answered brilliantly, "Wild ducks." Then, after they had flown away out of sight, Ma Tzu said, "Where are they now?" And Pai Chang said, "Flown away." Upon hearing this, Ma Tzu said, "So they flew away, huh?" And reached up, grabbed his nose, and twisted it so hard that Pai Chang cried out in extreme pain. You probably, if you've heard enough of these stories, you probably know or can suspect that Pai Chang also attained enlightenment at that very moment. That's not germane to what we're talking about, but I think when there are these enlightenment moments, that's when these stories get collected and passed down to us. So hang on to that story. We're going to get to what's going on pretty soon. Of course, it's pretty easy to tell where Pai Chang made his mistake. Ma Tzu was looking for Pai Chang's insight into the absolute. But his answer told him that he was still very attached to name and form. When we're attached to name and form, which I think at least some of the time includes everyone who's listening to this right now, we forget that everything is constantly changing. And when this change, which is often so subtle we don't notice it, when it becomes abrupt, we suffer, and we can suffer greatly. Insight into the absolute can ease that suffering, because it helps us see beyond name and form. And it helps us touch the nature of interbeing. In the absolute sense, as I hope all of us know by now, all things are one without distinction. So nothing comes and goes. Nothing is lost. So I ask you, where did the wild ducks go after they flew out of sight? I have to say, I'm really impressed that all of you look like you're concentrating on this question, because I thought it was not a very compelling question for us today, so we're already off to a good start. After all, it's not likely that any of us have a particularly strong attachment to a flock of ducks flying overhead and out of sight in ancient China. But what happens when you lose something or someone you care about deeply? That's what I want to talk about today. This is an important topic. Zen is often called the great work of life and death. Last Sunday, Sahara gave a beautiful talk about her experience as an end-of-life doula. I can't tell you how happy I was that she gave this talk, because it points straight to the heart of our practice. This tradition of ours asks us to look at the biggest questions. Where do we come from? Where do we go? Unfortunately, came up in Sahara's talk and the wonderful discussion that happened after that, our culture does its best to distract us from any of these thoughts. So many of us are unprepared for this inevitable transition. This is one of the few places where we can really look at this for ourselves. And we can either do like so many people do, distract ourselves, try to avoid these thoughts at all possible, in which case you're going to be running from it for the rest of your physical life. Or we can look at it, come to terms with it, at least to a certain extent. So even though Sahara gave this beautiful talk, I want to continue talking aspects of it and how we can practice with this. I so deeply value Zen, particularly because it invites us to do this. And I value having practices like the Jijang Bosal chanting we do, like the Kwansum Bosal chanting to do, and the recent 49-day ceremony, memorial ceremony we held for Jeff Tipp, Jita Pope's name, in which we can provide support both for ourselves and others. This is no small thing. It's a rarity in our society in general. And I have to say, I know that most of you here today, let's see, maybe four of us here today, let's see online, five. Few of us today knew Jeff, and most of the people who came to Jeff's ceremony were people who knew him personally. I realize that even though you may never have met Jeff, there's something we can learn from his passing that can start to open up our inquiry into this. Jeff's ceremony, by the way, I'm just going to take a couple of minutes. Jeff Tipp was a teacher in our school. Jeff Tipp began a meditation group, very small meditation group back in the 70s. And it gradually grew little by little. And at a certain point, he invited Zen Master Sung San to come to Seattle and lead a retreat. I don't know if he led more than one retreat or not, but Zen Master Sung San made this group that began with Jeff Tipp and a few others into a quantum school Zen center. No small thing. And he was such a constant presence for us who knew him. He touched us so many different ways. And as I was starting to say, Jeff's ceremony ran quite long, which I thought was really wonderful. And the reason for that is because almost everybody who showed up felt sincerely compelled to say something about the way Jeff had touched their lives, had changed their lives, I would dare say. So here are a couple of questions to throw out to get us to start looking at this question, this great, great in the sense that immense transition called death, which, by the way, is not the end of the story, because there is a Buddhist teaching called the wisdom of no birth and no death. We'll talk about that another time. So a couple of questions for you. Does our relationship with others end when we can no longer see them? Have they flown away like those wild ducks? Is that the story? Were the words that were spoken that night by all the people who attended, were they merely memories? Or is there something else going on? Here's another question that I was asked many years ago that might help us look more deeply into this. Can you see a child's smile when you gaze up at a cloud? This is the prelude to a little illustration of how that might be true. We all know that clouds give rain. The rain falls to the ground. It helps the grass grow. Cows eat the grass. Cows produce milk. Farmer milks the cow and takes it to a dairy. You know how this goes. It's turned into ice cream. And when the child sees that ice cream cone in his hand, a big, bright, beautiful smile appears. Every single one of those is, or the totality of those is just a small example of what occurs every moment throughout the universe. Everything is interdependent on one another. Cause and effect, even though we always start out with the word cause, happens simultaneously everywhere. Nothing is separate from anything else. So if you were there at Jeff's ceremony, could it be possible to perceive his presence in the people who spoke beyond their words? If you could see a smile when you look at a cloud, could you see Jeff when Debbie got up to say the words she spoke? Could you hear him in the bell, which he so dearly loved to play and was beautiful at? There's a Buddhist tradition of contemplating our own mortality that goes all the way back to the earliest Buddhist practices. And the purpose of contemplating one's own mortality can help us ease our fear of death. And help us stop brushing it under the rug. And it can help us really appreciate the life we have right here, right now. A couple of years ago, I attended a retreat that had a theme, and it focused during part of each day on Buddha's Parinirvana. Parinirvana is the fancy name for Buddha's physical death without what was widely believed and still is widely believed in many places around the world, without having to come back reincarnated. So in one part of the day, day by day, we learned what Buddha did on the last 7 days of his life. The other part of the day, the mornings, we got a chance, each of us got a chance to look at our own impermanence, the impermanence of our body, our physical body. I'm going to try to give you an idea of what that was like. They took place in the form of guided meditations that was very powerful, I think, for everybody who attended. But I have to just say it, by definition, is going to fall far short of what it's like to hear it secondhand. Each morning, after breakfast, we settled into meditation for a couple of rounds of sitting, just on, you know, in a group. And the Roshi, at one point, heard over her microphone, said, "Your body has just died painlessly. However, your consciousness still functions." He gave us a few minutes to just settle in with that, however we would. And after we sat with this for several minutes, she told us to try to visualize our current belongings, everything we think we own. That was a pretty big ask. Really looking, you know, of all of that stuff. And this is just the things we have that we think we own now. And between these prompts or questions, we're always left to sit with it for several minutes. Give us a lot of time to sink into it. So after a few minutes had passed, she asked us, where would all of these things be in 6 months? And my wife and I are in the process of downsizing our belongings right now. That's a big concern. You know, what do you do with all this stuff you've accumulated? But the next question was, where would these things you now own be in 50 years? And finally, she asked where they would be in 200 years. These things that, if we're attached to name and form, we mistake as permanent objects. The next morning, the process was essentially the same, but the specific line of questioning was different. She asked us to visualize our funeral. However, I mean, our consciousness is intact, no problem. So each of us started visualizing our funeral, and she asked us, who's there? Who couldn't make it? Then the question shifted to, Who would remember us in 50 years? My brother is in the process of scanning all of these old photo albums that go back to both of my parents and some as far as my grandparents. And he is so into it, I can't tell you. But trying to remember, this probably says more about our aging selves, but trying to remember, the two of us put our heads together and go, I recognize the face, but I don't have a clue who they were, how they fit into my parents' lives, et cetera, et cetera. So you get the picture. Who will remember us in 50 years? Who will remember us in 200 years? And finally, the grand finale was to envision the decay of our physical body, step by step by step. This, in fact, is a very specific meditation that early Buddhists did. I've never practiced in the Theravadin tradition, but I suspect they may still do that. It's called, I learned at this retreat, it's known as the meat body. After going through all this, to hear that phrase, the meat body, is kind of wakes you up. The Roshi, I should say, was a doctor during her whole working life and gave us an incredibly vivid description of how the body decays, going from the sort of liquid components to tissues, tendons falling away, the skeleton, and if you give it enough time, nothing's holding the skeleton together. I have to say it was incredibly powerful. I had what we call Dharma dialogues with her every night. And at one point, she asked me how I felt about my own death. And she knew that I had got really sick in 2021 because I had to make sure that my limitations would fit into the retreat. So she knew that. And I said, well, that sickness really, after practicing Zen for so many years, that sickness really made me look at it on a much more personal level. And I said, I feel like the combination of many years of practice and going through that, realizing how lucky I was that my daughters were adults at that point. My wife would be fine, in whatever relative sense you want to measure that. But, you know, I wasn't the sole breadwinner in the family while my daughters were 2 years old. And a lot of those things fell into place. And she offered that that's really good that you can have that perspective. She said a lot of people are really, I'm going to use my word for this, freaking out. So I think it's important that we don't ignore this. Now I want to say, just to finish up, say a few things about how we can practice with that. This Roshi was Roshi at a Zen center, but she's had a lifelong fascination with all branches on the tree of Buddhism, and she has invited teachers from other traditions not only to come and give talks, but actually become a teacher in residence for maybe 3 or 4 or 6 months at a time. And I know that she learned this guided meditation probably from a Theravadin teacher. We've almost never do guided meditations. In fact, the only time I can really remember one was when my teacher, Zen Master Jibong, was walking us through this, so we actually had familiarity with it. So in our particular Zen tradition, and I think you know this, our style of investigation is much more organic. As you know, we simply watch the coming and going, or if you want to call it the appearance and disappearance of thoughts and feelings in our consciousness, and focus on the coming and going of those thoughts and feelings, but without making commentary on them or starting to tell stories about that. That helps us learn to sit with things rather than always trying to think our way through it. So we're also taught to notice whenever our mind begins to lean. So Buddha kind of described that there are kind of three positions. A neutral position, thought comes up. Wow, the leaves are nice and yellow today. And then I hear a noise and my consciousness goes somewhere else. No problem. But if our mind leans towards a thought and we want to hang on to that thought, that's a thought that's sparking desire in us. I want this. Either my ego wants it or I feel incomplete. So I need to find things that will complete me and make me eternally happy and satisfied and somehow flatten all the bumps in the road of life. So the mind leans towards things we think are going to solve all our problems. Shopping, sex, getting famous, etc., etc. We know these, or at least we've heard of it from others, right? And then when we notice our mind leaning away from a thought and wants it to go away immediately and forever, in that cellar that's three stories down and locked tight with a big chain and lock and never appear again. That's our mind leaning away in aversion. The topic we're talking primarily about today, which is fear of death, is an example, but aversion can appear in any number of ways. Thoughts that remind you of a bad experience in childhood. Thoughts of having a shocking argument with somebody you thought was a close friend. And you're thrust into a point where you feel like, I'm not safe around that person. That's aversion. Either way, when we're noticing our mind leaning, we try to maintain our practice in the way that we're taught, by letting them come and go freely. And each time we do this, each time we let something that we have a natural aversion towards and can simply watch the coming and going, you will find, at least over a period of time, sometimes it's a long time, sometimes it's fairly quick, you'll find that it diminishes the power this fear that arises in you has. And over time, you will hopefully be able to say, oh, hi, I know you. Met you many, many times before. And come on in. Don't expect me to put the teapot on for you. Be fine if you only stay a little while. But you can kind of come to peace with that. And that's one of the really amazing parts about this meditation practice we have. To finish up today, I want to read a passage from a book by Zen Master Wu Kuang, one of the really amazing Zen masters in the Quantum School, one of the Zen Master Sung San's early American students. And he captures this point beautifully. And Debbie doesn't want me to mention her name, but it's too late. I just want to let you know that she read this at the end of practice last Tuesday, and I thought it was so spot on that I just wanted all of you to hear it. And I think it fits in beautifully with what we're talking about. It was part of a question and answer section in one of his books. And the student said, "I always thought that in the state of non-attachment, you have let go of the past so that you no longer experience any sense of loss. Will you comment on this?" And Zen Master Wu Kuang said, "The quote-unquote truth is in each experience, whether it's a narrow, focused experience or a wide, open experience. Sadness is truth. Happiness is truth. Loss is the truth. Grief is the truth. All of these things are truth. They're not in any way, shape, or form apart from the truth. If you really want to understand your human nature, then you have to be willing to enter into all of these aspects of living when they emerge, when they emerge. You don't have to go looking for them. You don't have to seek them out. But if, in the normal course of living, you come face to face with loss and grief, then loss and grief become your friends at that moment. They become your teachers and your partners. The more you try to get rid of them, the more they hang around haunting you." I tripped a little over the words, "they will become your friends," to be honest with you. But in a way they are, because they're helping you look at something that you might not do. Like a good friend. "Hey, I love you, you're a wonderful person, but you've got to pay attention to this. Really wonderful." While we're all, you know, trying to get to that wonderful state of before thinking where everything feels calm and peaceful, this is where the real work of meditation that sometimes we overlook can really change our lives for the better, and really help trauma that we've gone through, can really start to soften these so-called negative tape loops that run in our brain. So although we've focused on death and transitions, things appearing and disappearing, this kind of practice will work with absolutely whatever comes into your consciousness. We're in the middle of this really great retreat. And I mean, again, great in the sense that this is where we can really devote time to do this. So there's an opportunity to do that. And we sit and accept the truth of this moment. Thank you.